Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of my Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion on Samadhi and the Jhanas from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on October 10, 2017. The Samadhi Sutta shows the proper use of Shamatha Vipassana meditation practiced within the broader framework of the Eightfold Path. The Jhanas are not to be taken as mind states to achieve. They are simply an explanation of different levels of meditative absorption or meditative concentration. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So Samadhi and the Jhanas. Samadhi is a... first time I heard Samadhi, I knew I wanted it. I didn't know what it was, but I knew I wanted it. But it's a simple... it's an ancient Pali word that describes a simple quality of mind of non-distraction. And it's what we develop with the proper use of Shamatha Vipassana meditation. The Jhanas are simply levels of meditative absorption that are important to recognize so that they're like benchmarks as our meditation practice deepens. So we have a way of measuring our developing concentration. They were never taught as some meditative states to achieve because that just becomes another distraction. I want to get to the third jhana. They're just something to recognize. And as with everything the Buddha taught, samadhi, a non-distracted mind, different levels of meditative absorption are only important and applicable in developing understanding of Four Noble Truths. It's all the Buddha ever taught. Of course, when you understand that, you understand that the Buddha taught the most important teachings that we've ever had. The Samadhi Sutta shows the proper use of Shamatha Vipassana meditation practice within the broader framework of the Eightfold Path. The word meditation in modern Buddhist practice, and really just modern meditation practice or mindfulness practice, is often used as contemplation or analysis, and contemplation or analysis is not meditation, even if you're doing it quietly with your eyes closed. Topics popular for contemplation or analysis are suffering, emptiness, decomposition, conditionality, and many others. This overemphasizes simple and direct teachings, leading to distraction by analysis. So again, maybe I'm overemphasizing the point. Meditation is not the time to analyze anything. What comes up, come back to the sensation of breathing. And it really is off our cushion within the broader framework of the Eightfold Path that we gain useful insight, and that is insight into the three marks of existence. Contemplation of koans or wadu practice, which is a similar practice to koan practice. Wadu is a Korean koan practice, I guess is the best way to describe it. Are not something taught by the Buddha and should not be considered meditation practice within the framework of the Eightfold Path. And that's an important point that I need to make. If you or anybody listening is using koan or wadu practice, that's fine. Go ahead and use it, but understand it's simply not part of the Eightfold Path. It's just like doing anything else. It may be wholesome, it may be skillful, it may be beneficial. You also might find that it's distracting. The Buddha taught Shamatha Vipassana meditation as one factor of the Eightfold Path for the purpose of developing the concentration necessary to support the refined mindfulness of the other seven factors of the path. I think that's pretty understandable to everyone, right? I mean, I bring it up a lot. I mean, that's why we meditate, so we can hold in mind the entire Eightfold Path. At its most profound and skillful usefulness, it is concentration developed within the framework of the Eightfold Path that directly brings cessation of all confusion, delusion, and unsatisfactory experiences. It's all founded in a proper meditation practice. The Samadhi Sutta. The Buddha addresses those gathered. Friends, there are four qualities that are developed from concentration. Concentration, when developed in practice, leads to developing peace and calm here and now. Right? Nothing mystical or esoteric, and nothing terribly ambiguous. Peace and calm here and now. And I bet you every one of us, in the initial stages of meditation, recognize at least the beginning of a peaceful and calm mind. Is that right? And that also relates to the jhanas, and hopefully I'll get to that. I might not get to this whole sutta tonight. Number two, developing useful knowledge and true vision. Useful knowledge and true vision is rooted in and founded on and dependent on a skillful meditation practice. We need a well-concentrated mind to develop knowledge, useful knowledge and true vision. True vision simply points to right view, seeing things as they really are in relation to Four Noble Truths. Frank?
Developing useful knowledge of what? The Four Noble Truths and how they, yes, how they pertain to your own life?
Yes, that's useful knowledge of Four Noble Truths and also insight into the three marks of existence.
The arising and passing?
Yep. Yep. And so, again, it's an important point. Useful knowledge. You could use meditation for anything, like I began the article with. But it is used for a very specific reason. That well-concentrated mind supports developing useful knowledge of Four Noble Truths and so the three marks of existence.
And then the knowledge leads to understanding and then,
yep,
seeing?
Yep. When the Buddha described his own awakening, the first thing that he referenced was knowledge arose within me. So if you bring up a good point in relation to what the Buddha awakened to, dependent origination. What's ignorance? Ignorance is a lack of knowledge. The Buddha describing himself and all other awakened human beings have knowledge where there once was ignorance. Ignorance of what? Ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Useful knowledge of what? Knowledge of Four Noble Truths. And it's all that the Buddha ever taught. It took him, they say, 84,000 suttas, but that was just because situationally there was a different approach to explaining the Dhamma depending on who was in front of him and what the situation was. You could even say that the Ratana Sutta, you remember that was a sutta the Buddha gave to a town that was devastated by floods and disease. So it was situational, but the sutta itself spoke directly to the Four Noble Truths in gaining that knowledge.
And knowledge not in believing, but in experiencing.
Yes, everything. Everything the Buddha taught is to be experienced, not belief. He said over and over and over again, ehipasiko, come and see for yourself, which means that what I'm teaching you is not to be memorized, it's not to be doctrinized, it's to be experienced directly. And that really is what set the Buddha's teachings apart from everything else that was being taught during his time, and I would say everything that's taught today. It's to be experienced directly. There's nothing at all conceptual about it. Except perhaps in the initial stage, you know, we learn first intellectually, and then if it's a useful practice, then we can have the experience of developing that knowledge directly. We know for ourselves; we have a direct understanding of the nature of suffering. We have a direct understanding and knowledge that craving originates and clinging perpetuates that initial suffering. We have a direct experience of the cessation of ongoing confusion, delusion, and suffering. And we develop for ourselves the Eightfold Path. Nobody can develop it for us. A Buddha can't bestow it to us. It's not gained by any type of good acts except the good acts that are developed within the framework of the Eightfold Path.
So that useful knowledge leads to further investigation.
Yep. Within the right framework. Again, that's the Eightfold Path. Let me continue. Number three, developing refined mindfulness and attentiveness. So what does that refer to? Refined mindfulness means that it's refined to the factors of the Eightfold Path. It's not just a generalized mindfulness, almost how mindfulness is taught like a modern religion now. We need to be mindful of everything. Well, it's a good idea to be mindful of everything, but as far as the Dhamma is concerned, we're mindful of the eight factors of the Eightfold Path. That's what's most important. Helen, did you have your hand up?
Yeah.
Okay. Man, my eyes are going bad. Developing, number four, developing the cessation of craving, aversion, and delusion. Makes sense, doesn't it? That's the cause of all confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering is not understanding this process. So deep concentration leads to the direct development of the cessation of craving, aversion, and delusion. Lorna. Yes.
As you meditate, you build your meditation practice, the thoughts get less and you have more time maybe without thought. But having said that, so these, whatever they are, jhanas,
jhanas,
they must, you must, that's just in the space of thought? Hmm. Or is it like, if you meditate for 20 minutes, you might get there for the last 10 minutes solid?
I don't know that I would say that it's between the thoughts, but it is ever-deepening levels of meditative absorption, of deepening concentration. But when I get to the part on the jhanas, if I get to it tonight, you'll see that these are, they're ordinary qualities of mind, but extraordinary to an unawakened mind. But most of us experience at least three of these jhanas, again, I hope I get to it, in every meditation session. We just don't realize it. And many of us also experience the fourth jhana, which is simply a mind of resting in equanimity. I say like, because the jhanas are often taught like something for super advanced meditators that have been meditating in a cave for 600 years. And, you know, it's just not that. At least it's not that as the Buddha teaches it. Did I answer the question? At least kind of going towards it? Frank?
I guess I have a question about intention at that point. Like, the knowledge brings true vision. So with the experience of own personal contribution to craving and then suffering, or actually the clinging onto that idea or view, then setting the intention to abandon would lead to that fourth jhana?
It can, because if you find that you're getting too clinging even in your meditation, I think I've got the third jhana.
Even in meditation. I'm talking about off the cushion in everyday life. You've reached that peace and calm feeling. You've reached that knowledge and attentiveness and true vision. You've reached that level of mindfulness of your own moving towards craving and clinging.
Yep.
But at some point, sometimes it doesn't ungrip itself. And then setting the intention is sometimes difficult when in everyday life.
So the jhanas really don't apply that much to the situation you're describing. What does apply is a mind that is well concentrated enough to at least recognize when you're back to clinging into the world, when you're stuck in life again and stuck in a view that has a lot of you in it, I making in it. But that's part of the overall practice, it's necessary to develop a certain measure of concentration to recognize when you're caught up in that process. But the jhanas. The jhanas are only ancillary to that. They don't. It's not really something to consider at that point. And it'll become clear. And I should say, I hope this isn't it. Let me get to the jhanas before we continue, because it'll be more clear, I think, once I get to it. But I want to cover samadhi first.
So the jhanas really refer to the state, the different states while you're meditating on your cushion.
Yes, but they can also be carried off your cushion. Okay, so
in that they're quality of the mind.
Yes, and again, even when we develop them on our cushion, they're not something that we should hope to take off our cushion. If it develops that way, that's great. Let me get to it. So the Buddha continues. How does a development of concentration lead to peace and calm here and now? When properly engaged in shamatha vipassana meditation, one is withdrawn from sensuality and unskillful mental qualities. They enter and remain in the first jhana. He's describing that. We're withdrawn from the need for constant sensory stimulation. That's the first jhana. And every one of us experiences that, even if it's just momentarily, the minute we become mindful of the sensation of breathing. We might fall out of that level of meditative absorption in the next breath or in the next thought. But it's important to recognize that at least initially we're developing that first jhana. So the Buddha never qualified the experience of a jhana. And remember, this is just a word. It's an unfamiliar word, so we can put too much specialness on it. It's just describing something. He never said that it can't be a jhana unless it's 8 minutes long. It's simply something that develops from a meditation practice. But the reason why it's an important teaching, the reason why I'm talking about it tonight, is it's important to recognize that your meditation practice is having benefit. Your concentration is deepening. They enter and remain in the first jhana. Delight and pleasure, born of withdrawal and accompanied by focused thought and insight. Has everybody experienced that, at least for a moment or two? Yes?
This is where I bounce back and forth a lot in meditation. It's the withdrawing from craving and aversion.
In a direct way, yep.
And then it says the delight in focused thought.
Yes.
It brings me back to my thinking.
Focused thought, focused on the sensation of breathing. Not focused on...
Okay.
And probably the best word to use there would be that consciousness rooted in ignorance. Not focused on that. In this instant, you're thinking what you want to think when you want to think, which means you're thinking about your breath. Now is the time to meditate. During meditation, I think of my breath.
I think of my breath, or
well,
I experience
you,
my breath.
You're mindful of your breath, however you want to look at it.
Right. It's just that those descriptions are not always clear to me as to what it applies to.
Yeah, and
when I'm on my cushion.
Even the delight and pleasure born of withdrawal, that points to a quality of mind that we should be developing because we understand what this meditation practice within a broader framework will give us freedom, a mind of lasting peace and calm. We should be delighted in that. And how do we know that? Because an awakened human being did this and he's left us our teaching, or these teachings. Is that clear?
Getting
so,
clearer.
Okay.
From in that thoughts are arising and passing away,
mm-hmm.
but you're not thinking, you're not running through your lists, or you're doing the thing and you're doing this and then
right.
I have to think about that and think about that. There's thoughts are arising and passing away while you're maintaining awareness of the sensation of breathing in the body,
mm-hmm.
which isn't thinking. In the sense of running through your lists or your agendas, or
it's not a conditioned way of thinking.
The focus thought.
Yeah.
Observing.
Yeah, we have to use words that have multiple meanings.
Hmm.
So again, that's why it's so important to remember the context and what this sutta is presented in, but also the overall context. You could take any one of the suttas and not understand the context, and it just becomes a confusing story given by some crazy guy 2,600 years ago, because you don't have the context to see it. You know. Okay, let me go on. As concentration deepens further, they enter and remain in this second jhana. Focused thoughts and insight still. The light and pleasure born of composure and inner poise arise. So as we're deepening our concentration, the breath becomes almost an automatic thing. It's simply an underlying point of focus, and we have peace and calm in our minds. There's nothing arising, there's nothing passing away in that moment except our breath. And even our breath has now taken a smaller role in our meditation practice. Lorna described this really wonderfully well. This is maybe even a year ago when she said that her thoughts were here and her breath was up here. Meaning the thoughts are always flowing. And in this case, it's a subtle mindfulness of the sensation of breathing. But that mindfulness is starting to fade. And even that can be just for a brief moment. Again, there's no time qualification on any of these jhanas. And I bet every one of you has had that experience, haven't you? Except maybe Olivia. Have you had that yet? You might have. As concentration deepens further, they enter and remain in the third jhana. Delight and pleasure and the perception of pleasure and pain disappear. Again, remember, this isn't forever. It might just be for a moment. Equanimity and refined mindfulness increases, and a peaceful mind prevails. Has every one of you had that experience, at least for a moment, a peaceful mind that prevails? Remember, not prevailing for hours. It might just be, it could be prevailing for hours. I mean, a lot of you have also talked about, off your cushion, how your mind is simply more peaceful. That's a third jhana. But it's important in meditation to recognize that these levels are developing within us. So we're in agreement that most of you have had that experience of a peaceful mind that prevails. That's the third jhana. Nothing terribly extraordinary about it, is there? Except on the other hand, to a mind that is constantly, that was previously constantly distracted and never able to quiet down, it is extraordinary, isn't it? That you were able to do that for yourself with the right meditation in the proper framework. Develop a peaceful mind that prevails, even just if that prevalence is just for a few moments. But of course, we know that since we were able to develop it, even for a moment or two, continued practice will continue to develop that calm and peaceful mind. The Buddha continues. As concentration deepens further, they enter and remain in the fourth jhana. Mindful equanimity prevails. So there's two important words there, mindful and equanimity. We know that our minds are equanimous. They're at peace. They're at ease. Nothing shaking it. There's no agitation. There's no movement. There's no feeling. And we know it. That's the important part. We know it. Mindful equanimity. We're aware of the quality of our mind. That leads to that, to the fourth foundation of mindfulness, the instruction that I give at the end of every meditation session. Notice the quality of your mind. That's what we're referring to. So even if during meditation, that meditation, a particular one, you find that your mind is less than peaceful, it's important to notice it in a peaceful way. Be at peace with a less than peaceful mind state, because that's all part of developing a mind of equanimity. Let me go back to the beginning of that, the Buddha's description, just to feed into what I'll read. As concentration deepens further, they enter and remain in the fourth jhana. Mindful equanimity prevails. So I just got to preface this by saying that the common human problem known as the three defilements, the two of them are greed and aversion. Mindful equanimity prevails, greed and aversion disappear. In that moment, in that fourth jhana, the common human defilements of greed and aversion are no longer present. And I bet you every one of us has had that experience. That's the fourth jhana. Again, nothing extraordinary in it, except when you look at where our minds have come from, it is entirely extraordinary, isn't it? The Buddha continues, this is the development of concentration that brings peace and calm here and now. Referring all the way back to his description of the first jhana, isn't it? But that first jhana, that peaceful calm here and now, is just an initial foray. Where did I get that word from? An initial experience of ever-deepening concentration that ends in a mind of equanimity that we may or may not be able to maintain off our cushions, but at least during meditation we recognize it. And how does the development of concentration lead to developing useful knowledge and true vision? As concentration deepens, distractions subside. The Buddha is simply describing a well-developed meditation practice. Again, there's nothing advanced about this either. There's no such thing as an advanced meditator, as the Buddha teaches. Even the passing from day to night and night to day is free of disturbance. What a beautiful line. Just think about it. The passing of our life. It's just one continuous experience of a peaceful and calm mind. The occurrences that happen between the arising and the passing away of a full day no longer disturb our mind. I'm going to read it again. Even the passing from day to night and night to day is free of disturbance. The mind is bright and spacious. Look at a nice line, isn't it? The mind is bright. Man, just think about it. This is an awakened human being not trying to coerce people to develop the Dhamma, simply to explain what will happen if you develop this Dhamma. The mind is bright and spacious. This is the development of concentration that brings useful knowledge and true vision. a mind that's calm and spacious. Again, does anybody feel like that's unattainable to you?
Some days,
but in general, you feel that that's something that you could develop, a bright and spacious mind.
I think the longer I've stuck with this, the more likely it seems.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh yeah, it takes some right effort to be encouraged to continue with your right effort. Olivia.
Well, what about when you're having negative thoughts?
If it's during meditation, treat them like anything else, even though you've labeled it as a negative thought. Dispassionately come back to the sensation of breathing. Try to avoid at any cost wrestling with what's going on. If you remember that meditation is for deepening concentration, developing samadhi, whatever comes up during meditation is to be recognized as simply what's coming up and come back to the sensation of breathing. And even if you have a meditation session that's 10 minutes of agitated thoughts and you're constantly coming back to your breathing, back into those thoughts again, coming back to your breathing. Every time you come back to the sensation of breathing, you're deepening your concentration, and it's an effective meditation session. It's very, and we've all done this, it's very easy to fall into judging our meditation sessions as, you know, right or wrong, am I doing it right, was it helpful? As long as you're engaging in the method, it's a successful meditation session, and as you deepen the framework of the Eightfold Path, even those agitated thoughts will become less and less, but it's an important question. Thank you. Did I answer it well enough for you?
Yes. What about in our everyday life?
The same thing. I think you'll find as you deepen your practice, you'll have less of those experiences of an agitated mind. But it takes a while, you know, to work through to the place where you get to this lasting jhana of a peaceful and calm mind. More than a couple. I'm being a little bit flippant about it. If it takes a year or two, what's the big deal? You know, it's better to have to start now and know that it's possible to develop this rather than say, you know, if I can't have it all right now after 3 meditation sessions, I'm not going to do it. You know, it takes a little bit of practice, but you're doing well, you know, and being part of a Sangha and developing the Eightfold Path is all part of it. Do you notice any improvement? I mean, I know it's only been a couple of days, but since you, I think you first came on Saturday, right? Was it? Okay.
Maybe.
Yeah. I can't either, obviously.
I have a little baby, so, you know.
Yeah. I don't have that excuse.
I want to say yes, you know, but like, I've only come twice, but yes, I feel positive, you know, it's helping me with, like, a more positive attitude.
Yeah. Yeah, it is just like that. It doesn't take a long period of time to start feeling the benefits of this. It's pretty quick, you know.
Well, you cause me to, like, think in a different way, kind of.
That's exactly it. We go from, and this is what you're developing. We go from a conditioned way of thinking about the world and our relationship to the world to a mindful way that is simply present with what's occurring. And that really changes everything. It changes our entire experience of our own life. Which really is the point. So, thank you. Frank, you had something?
I was just going to add, when I came in here almost 2 years ago, I was kind of suffering with negative speech to self, and you guys were on right speech, I think, on that Truth of Happiness course, and you were talking about the importance of engaging in right speech with myself as well. You know, being gentle with myself and, you know, and what we think of ourselves is not a self. That was huge for me to understand that a little bit.
It took a while, though. I mean, it wasn't...
Well, you can't... The whole week was focused on that, you know, and yep. I went home, and that's where I started and kind of, like, tried to catch up. But it was really kind of like an eye-opener, I think, for me.
Yeah.
Because I had a lot of negative self-talk.
Yeah, most of us do. I mean, you know, one of the reasons why I always say be gentle with yourself is because it breaks that habit of thinking that if we could just beat ourselves up enough, we'll learn something. It just doesn't work that way. You know, we gotta...
When you said that, like, we're more than our thoughts, we're more than our emotions, that was a concept that was totally new to me, because sometimes when I would think a negative thought, like a jealous thought or something, I would think, God, I'm such a horrible person.
Yep.
You know, why would I think that? But now when I look at it, I can notice it and say, well, I didn't. I can practice, you know, thinking more positively, but I didn't tell my mind, like, hey, give me this thought right now. You know, give me this negative thought. It just kind of presented itself.
Yeah.
You know? So that helped me, like, not beat myself up as much.
Good.
You know? Because I think it's common for people to be cynical sometimes, you know. Like, it's just, you just have a thought, you know, and you think, geez, I'm such a jerk or something. You know what I mean?
I think we all know what you mean.
And then I judge myself and say, I'm so horrible, you know.
Yeah.
Like, well, I didn't really tell myself to think that thought, you know, as long as I don't act on it or, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, that thought is arising from a conditioned mind, and I know this is, you know, it's a little bit premature maybe to understand that completely, but you literally didn't have control of that thought. It was a reaction based on a habitual way of looking at the world and your relationships to the world that thought arises. So we gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it, meaning whatever is appropriate is what we'll think, rather than something, a conditioned reaction, a habitual reaction to life, including the way we look at ourselves. And what Frank mentioned about right speech, an aspect of right speech is what we're, that self-talk we got going on with ourselves, that story that we're always going over and over and again ourselves, directed at ourselves. It's so important to look at that in the framework of right speech, and very quickly we realize where we're sabotaging ourselves. So important. And it gets right to the heart of it. All right, let me go. Let me continue here. The mind is bright and spacious. This is the development of concentration that brings useful knowledge and true vision. And how does the development of concentration lead to developing refined mindfulness and attentiveness? As concentration deepens, the impermanence of feelings is understood. The arising and passing away of feelings, even what you just described, it's something that just came up. It's going to pass away. All things will, especially our thoughts and our thought constructs. And it's important to start recognizing that process, that even these things that I've been holding in mind my whole life, look at them. They're all impermanent. They're foam on the ocean. There's nothing there behind it. Let it go. It'll come back to what's occurring. As concentration deepens, the impermanence of perceptions is understood, meaning these views that have arisen out of ignorance. It's understood, and these are impermanent. There's nothing there. I can stop defending them, which means we stop defending this not-self-characteristic. As concentration deepens, the impermanence of all thoughts is understood. This is the development of concentration that brings refined mindfulness and attentiveness. And how does the development of concentration lead to developing the cessation of craving, aversion, and delusion? As concentration deepens, one remains attentive to the arising and passing away of the five clinging aggregates. The arising and passing away of this thing that we use as the personal experience of suffering. It's just as impermanent as everything else. Notice the arising and the passing away of it. One knows the impermanence of form, of feelings, of perceptions, of mental fabrications, and of consciousness. This is the development of concentration that brings the cessation of craving, aversion, and delusion. Friends, these are the four qualities that are developed from concentration. Those who understand the three marks of existence, for whom there are no disturbances, free of desire, at peace. This one has abandoned confusion, delusion, and disappointment. That's about a third of the way through this article, but it concludes the Samadhi Sutta. So that's enough. If you want to read more of it, you can. But we, in that sutta, the Buddha describes the importance of developing or using meditation to deepen concentration within the broader framework of the Eightfold Path. And then he described the levels of meditative absorption that occur within that well-focused practice that occur in an ordinary and common way, even though the effects are extraordinary. And so those four levels of meditative absorption are important to recognize that they're developing, because it reinforces your own practice. It lets you know that what you're doing is having the benefit. So that's tonight's talk. Thank you. We've already had some great questions and discussion, but any questions directly on the sutta, and then we'll go around the room. Frank.
The defilement of aversion,
mm-hmm.
is that what hatred is?
That's one, yes, that's one.
Hatred and ignorance of the noble truths?
of really anything that occurs in the phenomenal world, but certainly of the Four Noble Truths, so you'll never develop it. Yeah.
So under greed, they would be sensory pleasure, cravings and clings, and then hatred would be hindrances to meditation because of all those things that are involved in it, from jealousy to these obsessive and thought constructs of anger, anything that falls under that tree.
Yes, anything that all of that is part of, but there's an aspect of, yeah, remember, all of this is coming from a self-referential ego personality. So aversion could even be the using boredom during meditation to not want to meditate anymore. It's just too boring. That's aversion. So it's not just that, you know, that extreme example of hatred.
And is that all the five clinging aggregates? Like, what's experiencing that?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and ongoing consciousness rooted in ignorance is the five clinging aggregates. That describes the personal experience of ongoing suffering. So in other words, greed, aversion, and deluded thinking are the three defilements that we're talking about. Another word for greed is craving or desire. Another word for aversion is clinging in the sense of wanting something to be different than it is, which is also part of craving. It's simply the negative side of that same coin. Aversion is still desire. It's wanting something to be different than it is. And if it rises to the level of hatred, it's an extreme feeling of wanting something or someone to be different than they are. But it's all part of aversion. And it's all part of deluded thinking. And it's all part of thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths.
It's all dependent on the I, me, and I.
Yeah. And if you remember the progression of dependent origination, how that self-referential ignorant self is born through that process, all of it rooted in ignorance. So again, that first thing, knowledge, is the way out of ignorance, isn't it? For anything, you know, if you're ignorant of how to change the oil in a car and you learn how to do it, you have the knowledge of how to change the oil in a car. You're no longer ignorant of it. The Buddha found that to be true about these most essential four truths.
All this stuff happens pretty fast
it seems like it. It does. But that bright and spacious mind helps slow things down to a certain extent, too.
John Day, car? SUV is parked
in my spot.
SUV? Oh, are you parked in the back here?
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't park there. I'm sorry.
Not in that parking lot at all?
Yeah, not on this property.
Sorry about that.
I think I'll put a bigger sign up downstairs on our door. It's happened twice. All right, let's go around the room. Hear what you have to say and how your practice is going. Matt, good to see you tonight.
John, good to see you. Good to see everybody. A couple things. Something that Olivia had said and also Frank, that... you know, with negative thoughts, negative self-talk, all of that kind of habit pattern, when we develop our meditation practice and deepen concentration and develop that stability of mind, we gain insight into the three marks of existence, one of which is impermanence, in that we think a million different things during the day. We don't remember every single thing that we thought. We feel a million different ways during the day. We don't remember every single way that we felt because the nature of thoughts and feelings are impermanent. They're arising and passing away on their own all the time. So that is a direct way to let go of reacting to negative thoughts, reacting to negative self-talk, reacting to personalizing those experiences. So it's the importance of meditation practice in developing the Eightfold Path is huge.
It is. It's everything. when you recognize the impermanence of all things, you let go of everything. You know, why hold on to something that is fleeting? Jean, good to see you again.
Nice speaker. Very busy kind of transition time in my life. I feel like I'm starting a whole new life, which is kind of fun.
Yeah.
But
good place to start it, right?
With the impermanence thing, one of my favorite ways of dealing with it is with nature. And this is such a good time of the year to do that, because you can see visually everything changing.
Yeah.
And to go from the green that was so everywhere and so intense, and to watch the little flecks of gold appearing in the trees and all falling on the grass, these golden things out of the second floor window look amazing.
Yeah.
And so, and to know that, you know, it's really beautiful, but not too long, they'll all be down, and it'll be brown, and we'll start to see the snow again. And so that, to me, has always been, you know, noticing the colors as I'm driving. What kind of a message might feel this, the Hestrian symbolism of flower decoration? And so last month I sent out a thing of when you're whizzing down the road, just notice these golden fields of flowers. They're pretty much gone now. But and I put close-ups of several of them, and sunflowers and gardens and things like that. And yellow and gold are the color and healing of insight, illumination, and inspiration. And so it's almost like Mother Nature is giving us a big dose of inspiration to deal with this time of the year, which is, you know, kind of transitory and whatever.
Yeah.
So anyway, I always feel good about relating what's going on with impermanence to what's the message from nature right now? The green is growth and healing and service. And so we have a lot of that for a while, and now it's kind of changing. So anyway, that's my thing.
Yeah, thank you. And it starts bringing us more inwards, too, I think, this time of year. We're going to be up on retreat next week in the Catskills, and it should be pretty wonderful.
It should be, really.
Yeah.
It'll be beautiful up there because it's further along.
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping.
Yeah.
Clinging to it.
I've noticed that every time I go through that Samadhi Sutta that I have, just another deeper level of looking at it. The first few times it was just, I was just, what you said, not to do, was like trying to get to those levels, you know, and I have to unlearn so much. It's just, it keeps coming back. You know, the good meditations are always where I can just, at the end, look at my state of mind and say, okay, I have a state of mind. and not judge it.
Yep.
I'm still working on it, and it's been a year and a half of daily meditation now, and still every day I have to remind myself, yes, it's a state of mind.
Yeah.
Continue.
Yeah, but that's a great place to be, and a great awareness to have.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to break that conditioned thinking then.
Because I spent decades judging that state of mind.
That's the way a lot of meditation is taught, that it's about achieving something.
Mm-hmm.
And of course you could say deepening concentration is that achievement, but if it's done within the right framework, there's no I in there. You know, it's just a well-concentrated quality of mind. But, I mean, I think about some of the meditation methods I practice and people I study with, and there was always often some magical, mystical quality of mind. You know, very enticing. But
luckily, I never got there, so I never got a chance to
cling
to it.
Maybe one of these days I'll come clean. I'll drink a half a bottle of vodka and open up to everyone. Tell you some stories about mind states to achieve, but they were just all At least I think they're all in my imagination. But what an imagination I had at one time. Andrew, good to see you.
Can you characterize again the three jhanas?
The four jhanas. The first is simply a lessening of your need for sensory input. It really is the initial phase of the mind quieting down. And again, it could be just, you know, for a brief moment or two. But for this moment, I don't need constant distraction. You can say that's the first jhana. The second jhana is a recognition that a peaceful mind state is developing and has developed. Even if, it's just for a moment. And you're starting to withdraw even deeper from the need for constant sensory stimulation. The third jhana, and let me explain it this way because it's a little bit more easily understood in the continuation of that experience. The third jhana is the deepening of that experience, but you're now recognizing that a peaceful mind is present. You're aware of that. And so, again, without getting into mystical terms, and the Buddha wouldn't use mystical terms either, the fourth jhana is simply knowing on an experiential level that mind that is resting in equanimity. And maybe to use the word locked into it, even if it's just for a few moments. And then so that fourth jhana is something, and remember how the Buddha concluded this. He concluded by saying a peaceful quality of mind. So it's all really part of that initial entrance into the jhanas. It's simply a deepening level of meditative absorption. So again, thank you for asking. So first in meditation, we quiet our minds. We start withdrawing ourselves from the need for constant sensory stimulation. You can say that's the first jhana. You could accurately say that when you first become mindful of your breath, and you notice, the important part is noticing, a slightly calmer or peaceful mind, that's the first jhana. And as those levels of peacefulness deepen and you're aware of it, it's both of those things, you're deepening, you're having deeper levels of meditative absorption or jhanas. Until finally, and it doesn't have to, and I don't mean years, it could be within your very first meditation experience, and it could be in every meditation session that you have, you recognize in a profound way that mind of equanimity. Your mind is at peace. There's nothing disturbing it. And the knowledge that goes away with that goes along with that fourth jhana is first the initial understanding that you did it, that you were able to develop that mind state on your own through the proper method. And then finally you know that it's unwavering. And that unwavering part is the awakened, fully mature human being. And that's not unachievable by anyone. So thank you for asking that question. Helen, good to see you.
Thank you, John. Good to be here. I came back to that beautiful illustration composed by Lorna and Matt some time ago about the sky is your mind and the clouds are your thoughts. And then just bringing in the breeze as you're breathing and how just imagine lying on your back and experiencing that. That's what a great meditation is like. So it's the thoughts are still coming, like the clouds are still passing.
Yeah.
But you're just aware that they're passing. They're coming and they're passing. You're not looking for the shapes in them or anything. You're just letting them pass. And your mind is just there as they're passing. And then you just come back to the awareness of the breath, the breeze around you, and that whole feeling of equanimity that comes with that. And that's just a beautiful image that came together in this room. It's just perfect, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. Thank you. That's a lot more illustrative than the purpose of meditation is to not be distracted by your own thoughts. but it is the purpose. Greg, good to see you.
John, good to see you. I guess I haven't been here since Tuesday of last week. And I've been reading your book thoroughly and enjoying it thoroughly.
Thank you.
And if anyone still hasn't read it, I highly recommend it. I feel like the quality of meditation has gotten much better since I've been coming here and since I've been daily, you know, reading about the context and really integrating it into my life as I go about my daily activities. And for me, speaking specifically about samadhi and the my meditation was all over the place. It had no real purpose, or I was always shooting for the higher jhanas, and I thought this this one goal of like ego loss and, you know, a halo would appear and lightning bolts and dissolution into the universe and cosmic forces and this is actually way more satisfying. Because it's, you know, it actually means something. It's applicable. And, for me, samadhi, just the concentration factor, you know, once it finally clicked that the concentration is to support the Eightfold Path, the meditation itself took on new meaning. And, you know, when you have no doubt, when there's less analysis going on, so there's much less distraction.
Yeah.
And it's simply any thoughts that arise, that, you know, deal with them when you're done meditating. For me, it was extremely important to look at it not just as a that there are physical results from the process. That every time your mind wanders and you bring it back to the breath, every time you do that, even if you have a terrible sit, you know, terrible in air quotes, because you felt like you've drifted too much. Every time, though, that you've pulled yourself back, you're reinforcing that, and you're building those, you know, the neuroplasticity. You're actually changing the brain.
Yeah.
You're building those connections. The brain regions are changing. And even if you feel like it's not going anywhere, like, any effort you put in is time well spent. And then, you know, that to me has just changed. That feeling of positivity and optimism that this is going somewhere, there's no doubt about it. It has to. There's only one place it can go. There's only one result of this practice, and it is a, you know, more refined concentration, a better understanding that'll lead to insight. And it's just really nice when you realize you're on this course that's just kind of taking you, and you, you know. And yeah, so that's where I'm at.
Thank you. It's a nice place to be, isn't it? There's been quite a few studies now that show how that meditation affects the basic structure of our brains, and so we're building a brain that is more structurally inclined towards concentration by doing this correctly. You use an interesting word, that it's much more satisfying. So dukkha, in a general way, means unsatisfactory. So all those experiences of bursting into a million different lights and traveling the universes and all that stuff, that ultimately is unsatisfactory because it doesn't last. But this develops something that leads to an awakened, fully mature human mind, human being. So,
I think it's important to quickly note, too, that you can experience some of these, you know, jhanas or other, you know, amazing mystical type experiences, the ego loss, all that, without having the context or the practice, you know. You know, drug-induced or otherwise, you know, maybe in a few years we'll be able to induce it by technology. But without the context, it's really, people are just, it doesn't, you know. It's not these states alone, they're just supplemental to the path.
It has no real practical effect.
Right.
I don't know that it's all that common anymore. Years and years ago, there was getting into a flotation chamber was a very popular thing to do, and you had a pretty quick experience of nothing. I mean, if you stayed in there, it didn't take all that long for me, but you just, you know, because of the environment, you just lose any sense of anything.
Sensory deprivation.
Yeah, but as soon as you're out of it, you know, what I experienced was a great disappointment that I had to come out of it. You know, honestly. You know. It didn't last. Olivia, it's good to see you tonight. How's your practice going?
Good so far.
Good. You're able to I think from what you said before, you're able to use this method. You find when you're caught up in your thoughts, you come back to the sensation of breathing. That's the basic practice. Was tonight's talk helpful in giving you some, at least a general idea of the purpose of meditation? Good. There's a little bit more. Yeah, stress. That's the practice, yeah, and I think we can all say that you will.
Because I feel like I'm someone who, my happiness has always come from external things, just grabbing onto anything that like makes me feel good, you know?
Yeah.
On,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
and it's never enough. No matter, the self-referential ego self is insatiable. It always is. You know, the more you feed it, the more it wants. But this is the counter to that, and it's what you develop yourself within these teachings, within the broader framework, that gives you that really that literal control that you can practice restraint at those things. So I'm glad you're here, and hope you keep coming. Sure.
What are your thoughts on, like, is it, I'm not better, but I like meditating with a group of people.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's like, I guess it's nice, like the energy, like it feels like
yeah.
It's positive energy. But also meditating alone, it seems like it could be a good practice, I guess, as well, because you're really alone in yourself, you know, like you're
yes.
really alone. Which I guess can be scary sometimes, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we talked about that last week, fear coming up during meditation. It really, the most effective practice will have both of those components. You'll be part of a well-focused sangha that we're fortunate to have here, but you'll also develop a practice at home.
Yeah.
So again, I think I've said this already, but if you start with just short periods of meditation, 2 or 3 or 4 minutes, and if you can do that twice a day, about 12 hours apart, and then be part of our sangha, you'll have a well-established meditation practice. All of us started with that idea of short periods of meditation. Consistency is much more important than length of time, especially in the beginning. And I think I told you there's guided meditations from 5 minutes to 45 minutes on my website that you can download and help guide your practice, too.
I plan on doing those.
Okay. Yeah. Either one, crossrivermeditation.com or becoming-buddha.com. Most of the content now is on becoming-buddha.com. You have any trouble with it, just send me an email and I'll help you out with it. But so glad you're a part of our sangha.
Thank you.
Frank, good to see you tonight.
Good to be here tonight. Hello, Olivia. I think she had some beautiful insights already.
Yep.
I see the first task of the first noble truth is to see your own contribution to suffering.
Yeah.
You know, first and moving into the second noble truth. And if you can gain insight into those grasping and craving and clinging, then that's like half the battle, I think.
Yeah, it is.
Meditation, for me, is going great. And that solitude meditation in the morning is where I experience probably the greatest depth of meditation, if I was to describe it. Moving into my day, it becomes a challenge because I have to be where I'm at. And so the meditation gives me the ability to experience all the, and you know, when it says greed, I guess that's all the sensual desires under greed.
Yeah.
And aversion, and I don't want to say too much delusion because I know what's going on. I'm not ignorant of that fact. I kind of, I know where it's all coming from. And I feel the cessation of my own personal struggle with the suffering. But I don't know if the jhanas, I think I read in that article that the main reason for the Buddha teaching that was to not have people think that they've achieved certain levels of like some special level of meditation.
Yep.
And it's whatever notions that you have, you know. So if I'm thinking about that stuff while I'm on the cushion, then the whole purpose of meditating is to abandon thoughts and return to the breath. So that's just another distraction for me.
Yep.
So I like to keep it simple. And keep coming back, it's great.
You always do keep it simple, Frank. Thank you. And there, like I said, that was about a third of the article that I read. So the Buddha does get into almost chastising people that were, it was obvious that they were, you know, enamored with their meditative absorption. He was basically saying, if you're meditating correctly, everybody has that. So don't make too much of it, but recognize that your practice is having an effect, a beneficial effect too. Lorna, good to see you.
I'm grateful for this talk tonight because it does make you realize and think about what we kind of maybe take for granted.
Mm-hmm.
And by taking it for granted, we don't then focus on it and focus on the development that was made to have the success with that. So I think to look at meditation like this, I think is a good thing to do. That it, you just appreciate and understand the process a little bit more clearly.
Yeah.
And I think that's good. What I've been focusing mainly is when I'm meditating on the cushion, to some extent off the cushion, is to take myself out of meditation, meaning try not to manipulate my breath, which I find very challenging. I'm always like bigger breath, deeper breath, shallower breath, and trying to take yourself out of meditation. And I think I understand that I'm going to carry on breathing, whether I'm thinking about it or not.
Hopefully.
Stop. It's like your heart beating, and you know, you could even breathe through. When you fall asleep, you still keep on breathing, and you're not paying any attention to it. So I know it's going to happen anyway, but I find it difficult just to leave it alone. Just to leave it alone and not.
Thank you for that. That's so important. the a misunderstanding and misapplication of the Satipatthana Sutta, people use that to think that we should manipulate our breaths in certain ways. We should manufacture long breaths and short breaths and deep breaths and shallow breaths. And that's when you look at that entire sutta, it says just that. Just recognize this is how your breath is presenting itself now, and just let it be that way. You know, and any time we try to manipulate our breath, it's going to prove to be a distraction and take away from concentration. So thank you for saying that. Liz, good to see you.
Good to see you. Good to be here. I don't really have that much to say. I'm trying to focus on getting back into two sits a day. But, you know, the thing I appreciate the most about this whole package of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path is the way it constantly folds back in on itself.
Mm-hmm.
Taking a moment to say, what is the quality of my mind? Looking into what am I being ignorant about that's creating whatever the state of mind might be. Folding back into the Four Noble Truths and then folding back into the Eightfold Path to create some sort of structure to, you know, this whole path and system and stuff. I'm just so appreciative of that.
Thank you. I'm going to put you on a spot for a moment, but if you may not be able to describe what I'm going to ask you, because it, you know, it might just be hard to describe. When you're noticing the quality of your mind, and that quality of your mind is less than ideal,
mm-hmm.
what follows from that? Can you describe that?
If I catch it, and it doesn't continue to arise into something else, some kind of mental fabrication, or even if it does, just bringing it back to, you know, dukkha exists, and, you know, there's a chance of moving away from dukkha just by accepting it for what it is and not folding into it with the clinging aggregates, and bringing it back to the breath and realizing it's not me, it's not mine, it's not who I am.
Yeah.
There's just so many points along the way when you can make the decision to go into the abyss or go have the top of your head fly off or whatever it is. I mean, I'm pretty good at that. But to bring it, to kind of reel it all in, but not in a negative or a panicking kind of way, or you know, having a difficulty with myself saying, oh, there you go again, or whatever. To just sort of reel it all in, and, I mean, it's such a relief.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the whole idea, too, of knowing that none of this is mystical or magical or whatever is a relief, too.
Isn't it?
Because I never really had those experiences, and I thought I was missing something, you know. This is just so practical and so... I was having a conversation with someone the other day about all of this, and they kept saying, well, it's good to have a spiritual practice. And I said, well, this isn't really... For me, it isn't really a spiritual practice. It's a practical way of living my life and moving away from, you know, the high highs and the low lows and not having to react to everything. And they said, well, you know, that is a spiritual practice. And they kept wanting it to be a spiritual practice. And they have their own practice based on Catholicism and stuff, and so... And I understand and respect that that's very important to them. But, you know, even just saying to them, you know, Buddhism is actually, you know, a philosophy and a path based on a certain way of, you know, organizing yourself. And you know, they just, you know, the conversation kept going off into this, you know, just really wanted it to be so that we could be similar in mind, that we were both, we were, isn't it great that we both have a spiritual path?
Yeah.
And, you know, not judging him or anything, and, you know, I just had to kind of just let it go, and, you know, I wasn't going to get into an argument with him about, you know,
your spiritual
practice. My spiritual practice. I wasn't going to arm wrestle him for
it wouldn't have gone anywhere.
Anyway, it's just, I love the way it just folds back in on itself, and you can stop yourself from conditioned mind at any point along the way.
Yeah.
That's really helpful to me.
Yeah. Noticing the quality of your mind. Thank you for that. There's always this push, you know, to reconcile everything into one, you know, it's all spiritual practice. It's all kind of the same thing. It all goes to the same place. And it doesn't. You know, it's, to me, I don't care what kind of label people put on it, but a spiritual practice implies that there's something extra physical that we're aspiring to or counting on for our liberation. And so there's nothing, in that sense, nothing spiritual about this. It's simply a way of changing the way we're thinking from ignorant wrong views to knowledgeable right views. And that's all it is. And that, when you first answered my question, and thank you for answering it, you said that you noticed dukkha. And that is such an important and insightful thing, to recognize that an agitated mind state is not right or wrong. It's part of dukkha. How does dukkha occur? From craving and clinging. And that points directly to the heart of the matter, how we can change that quality of our mind. So thank you. I didn't mean to put you on the spot, but you answered it beautifully. You get a gold star. Bonnie, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. And I was thinking about my practice, and as you just said, you're like, that's it. So I'm thinking the meditation has been like such a relief. You know, and I've had a lot of experiences in the past few weeks to have a lot of practice to observe this phenomena of the practice. So actually we've been trying to increase our also sit time at home. And it really, sometimes I just don't sit for long periods of time, but I do it often throughout the day to breathe, but it really, it's like a relief because I don't have to do anything. You know, I think of the practice of non-judgment of myself has been most beneficial, and I think I kind of, because I've been at this now for a while, I almost like not forget what I learned initially, but that to sort of remind myself to go back to the beginning and look at, you know, the compassion. And I have a lot of conversations with people about compassion. Sometimes they like, I don't even know what you're talking about. They don't know how to find it in themselves or where to recognize it. So practicing, then it's a good, I become my own guide, and then I can be kind of a guide. But yeah, the meditation is like, whew, even if I have monkey mind and I don't have, you know, quiet mind, it just gives me permission to stop and allow the thoughts to come. So,
yeah, thank you. In that way, it's a refuge from your own busy mind, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you. A few announcements. Our Donna dinner is November 21st, Tuesday of Thanksgiving week. There's info on crossrivermeditation.com. As usual, we'd like some volunteers to help set up and break down, and I'm going to get a basket out there for some contributions that will go to Julie to pay for her help. She's very generous, but she shouldn't have to pay for that part of it, so we'll come up with a couple of bucks. And then we're going to, as soon as I get around to it, we're going to establish the Rare and Learning Cooperative Mary Beth School in Flemington, Alternative High School, as our ongoing Donna project. And I'll get some info on that. There's still, I think, 2 beds left for retreat. If you want to go, now's the time to join us. And that begins a week from Thursday. So there'll be a class this Thursday and this Saturday, but next week there won't be a Thursday and Saturday class, but we will have a Tuesday class. All right, let's conclude with metta as we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. Just get a feel for what that's like. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk today. And metta means goodwill or loving kindness. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.